Good morning. Lovely to have this opportunity to speak and see all of you wonderful people from up here rather than back there. The theme, since Cahal was playing tapes on forgiveness, I thought this would be a good time to just talk about forgiveness and what does forgiveness do to us, do for us? How does forgiveness factor into living spiritually? And the short answer is that forgiveness is our means to spiritual freedom. If you think of forgiveness, you think of the scripture, Christianity is really based on the idea of forgiveness. There are so many references in the Master's teaching to forgiveness. Before you go into prayer, from the Lord's Prayer, you have to forgive. Forgive any resentment, any kind of condemnation that you're holding anybody. Otherwise, your prayer will not be effective. How many times do you forgive? When Peter asked that, he thought that, well, if you forgave somebody, it was a human act. It was like pardon. It was like, oh, okay, you're still in the human frame of living, and I'll pardon you for that transgression. But that's not what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is really seeing through that human appearance and realizing the oneness of all life. So Jesus said to Peter, you have to forgive 70 times 7, which means that you're constantly forgiving what you see in this world until it no longer is a part of your consciousness. When it's no longer a part of your consciousness, that which is upsetting, that which is hateful, or that which seems to be destructive, when it's no longer a part of your consciousness, it doesn't come into your life. And forgiveness is the way that we detach ourselves from these appearances. Forgive others as the Lord has forgiven you. God knows nothing of this material situation, material life, the spiritual life, life itself, the life that is the core of who we are, is untouched by the human appearances of good and evil. We deal with them while we are in this state of consciousness, but we are not stuck in this state of consciousness. We are not stuck being victims of material cause and effect, because within each and every one of us is that Christ, that spiritual I, and that does not deal with this world. That does not live in this world. That is an activity of spiritual creation, spiritual life, flowing through the individual that has the awareness to perceive that. So the forgiveness that is of God is not a pardon. It is not as it becomes interpreted from a material point of view. It is it is paired with sin. If we're sinners, we have to be forgiven. Once we are forgiven, we are able then or capable of experiencing the divine. Well, if we put that in metaphysical terms, and we don't use the term sinner, but if we are hypnotized by the belief of good and evil in this world, then we are not going to experience the divine because we are stuck with this perception. As soon as we step out of that paradigm, that perception, what have we done? Through forgiveness, we have moved, and this forgiveness is the forgiveness of God. Because God knows nothing of this material world, when that activity comes into us, it wipes clean all of that belief that would hold us in bondage to material cause and effect. It's a belief. It has nothing to do with God. So as God, as the Lord forgives us, which is basically seeing us as spiritual being, we must forgive one another, which is not holding any individual in condemnation. Not holding an individual in condemnation to behavior, to disease, to sin, to age, to any of the material appearances that we peg people with. I mean, we're always, everyone I'm sure does this. It's human nature. When we want to identify somebody, when we want to describe somebody, we put some human characteristic to it. Male or female, or their race, or their age, or whatever it is that is a human identification. Now, forgiveness really is removing that human identification and realizing that when we go to identify someone, we identify that spiritual nature. We identify the Christ. We look through that appearance of whatever is in front of us and know that right there is this spiritual being, this one, inseparable from God, my brother, my sister, because we are all one in this spiritual manifestation of the divine. Love one another as I have loved you. Now, forgiveness is the means to unconditioned love. In my book, which I'm going to read some of this today because I did a whole area on forgiveness, I, for teaching purposes, came up with seven principles, spiritual principles. And it's not like there's only seven principles, but these, in going through all of the different aspects of the nature of spirit, the nature of God, these principles were the one that came to me that seemed to define best the nature of the spiritual realm. First principle is oneness. There is only one presence. There's only one life. There's only one law. There's only one cause. And that cause is spiritual. So that removes from our attention, from our mentality, the idea of material cause and effect. And these principles, a principle is defined as the how something works or the nature of a thing. So when we have principles, we have a definition of how a certain thing works. In mathematics, there are certain different principles of mathematics. There's multiplication principles, division, there's algebra, there's geometry. All these, you can say, are part of this idea of mathematics, and they are the principles that give the individual the means to practice, to solve problems. Mathematics really is just another language for problem solving on a different level than using words. Words are more fluid in a way. Words are more subjective, where the language of mathematics is pretty cut and dry. 2 + 2 = 4, and you can't really alter that. If you know, it won't work. Language, you can shade and you can manipulate, and different people have different perceptions of what words mean. So in our language, in our spiritual language, these principles or these terms help us to understand what something as infinite as oneness is. When you say, we are very comfortable with terms like oneness and nowness and omnipotence because we have studied these for so long, but someone that is not studying mysticism, the idea of oneness can seem like, well, what does that mean? Well, it goes back to the original realization of man's nature with the divine, which is one. It came through Moses. It came even before Moses. But this oneness that was is an experience. How do you define an experience? How do you teach an experience? How do you give a people, a population, an experience? It's, you can't give them an experience just through words, just through talking. The experience comes in this atmosphere of being in that divine presence. So in ancient times, rituals developed around oneness, and those rituals helped to bring people into an experience when they were together that, oh, this is what I feel. So this is what I, if I have this feeling in the knowledge that, that this presence that I feel is omnipotent, that it is the only, then what do I have to fear? What do I have to contend with? What do I have to do in this world when I'm in this awareness of spirit that goes before me and brings the harmony and the peace and the joy and the happiness? So that whatever our way of life, we have this satisfaction. We have this completeness. We have this joy. We know, and for all of these principles, there is, that are spiritual, that are really esoteric, there is an exoteric correlation. That is what we use mentally in this world to nullify the hypnotism of material sense. So to be one, we can't be one in a personalized state. So the human activity of realizing a state of oneness is impersonalization. We impersonalize all good. We impersonalize all evil. We impersonalize all the effect of this material sense of cause. It isn't because of you. It isn't because of anyone. It is a belief that there is a power outside of God. If God is one, how can there be any other power? That's the age-old question that philosophers and religions have always asked. And people who are atheists or agnostics say, well, if God is omnipotent, how come there's evil in the world? And it's a very difficult question to answer on the level of the question from a material point of view. It's like the Zen cone of asking somebody what's the sound of one hand clapping. If you focus on the question and try to solve the question, you'll never have any kind of a spiritual realization. But when you realize that evil is just a state of ignorance, that evil is that state that is unaware of the omnipresence of God, and it is a universal belief that has been given power by the acceptance of this belief by mankind, humankind, then you realize, oh, I don't have to contend with that. If I want to experience the divine, if I want to experience the peace and the harmony and joy of the spirit, then I can't do that and contend and battle and fight with evil. That's why Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount said, resist not evil. Love your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. Why? That sounds so impractical. But it is the way that we move out of being subject to material cause and effect and into the realm of spirit. Forgiveness is one of the great tools that we have that brings us into the activity of love. Forgiveness is the exoteric activity to bring us into the esoteric realm of unconditioned love. That realm, we realize that everything that is created in love. That there is nothing that exists outside of love. And how do we experience this unconditioned love? Do we experience it by through forgiveness. Forgiveness is one of these metaphysical or philosophical tools that bring us into the experience. Since the experience is beyond words, and the experience of this spiritual presence is ever present, our function is to find a way through our mental belief structure, through the hypnotism of this world, to that experience of the divine. And forgiveness is one of those ways. In contemplating this, the forgiveness, if you had a stick and one end of that stick was judgment, the other end of that stick will be forgiveness, because forgiveness nullifies judgment. It brings us to that point of righteous judgment where we see through the appearance of this world. Now, judgment isn't spiritual. Forgiveness in and of itself really isn't spiritual either. It is that activity that nullifies human judgment that brings us to a state of mind whereby we are not attached to this world, to the concepts, the beliefs, the sensations of this world. And when we're not attached then to this world, we are free to experience that divine presence within. And that divine presence now, just I'll move through some of these principles because they help us to understand this being in the world but not of it. The spirit is beyond time and space. There was this interesting thing that I heard yesterday on the radio about the Voyager spacecraft that has left our solar system. I didn't realize that if you think of our sun, you know, it's sending out waves, and it's sending out waves in every single direction. And these waves are cosmic waves. And the Voyager was picking up all of these waves. And then it came to a point where it was not picking up these waves. And the scientists thought, well, maybe this solar wave, if you just think of a wind, a solar wind going out, it only goes out so far, and then it dies. And then at the edge of this wave, the Voyager was picking up all kinds of different kind of particles or different kind of signals that we're sending back. And so they describe this as like being inside of a giant bubble. The sun is the center of our bubble. The whole solar system exists within this bubble because the whole solar system is within this solar wind, within this radiation belt. But when you get out so far, then you have this edge. And so we have a certain environment within this whole solar system. But our solar system, when you look at it in the context of the universe, is absolutely infinitesimal. There's a video on, I've seen it on Facebook, but it's a YouTube video that takes a picture of the Earth, and then it just starts going back and back and back. The solar system, our star, and then back, and then the Milky Way galaxy, and then back and back and back, until you have gone back in time 13 billion or something like that years, and you see this, okay, this is like our known universe, and they have it pictured just in a black space. And then you move back into what we know. And so what we know physically through astronomy is all based on time and space. But now, where does all this exist? Does this exist without consciousness? Does this exist just as a bubble, and within a bubble, within a bigger bubble, within a bigger bubble? But where does this bubble exist? Where do the galaxies exist? Where does the universe exist? They all exist in consciousness, and that consciousness is now. There's no time or space in that consciousness. Time and space are relative to trying to measure distance. So we had a video that showed us going back 13 billion years in time, which is equivalent to a space, but I watched it in 3 minutes. So time is totally relevant to the measurements and the perceptions of what are taking place in the moment. Spiritually, when we realize that everything functions, that God, Spirit, functions in the now, then that now awareness wipes out all sense of regrets of the past. It wipes out all awareness of the past that would bring you into a human experience, and it wipes out the future, because the future does not exist except in one's imagination. A Hindu guru had, and I can't remember his name, on one YouTube video said, the past is all memory and the future is all fantasy. So if you want to live in fantasy or you want to live in memory, either place of living is not really living. It's not in the now. It's not real. It doesn't have any substance. And what is the substance of reality? Spirit. God. The infinite invisible. And this world is complete. So when you're looking at your own evolution, your own pursuit of happiness, when you realize that everything that in my spiritual awareness, in my spiritual oneness with the divine, everything is complete. My life is complete. There's nothing that I need to add. There's nothing that can be added to me, because all of life right now is complete. I am living this particular experience, and I'm living it in the now moment. And in that now moment, what do I experience? I experience peace. I experience joy, happiness. I experience a sense of well-being. What is well-being? It's being with an adjective to it. Being is the crux. I am. I am that I am. Being expressing itself. That is the nature of the spirit. Mystical reality. Being expresses itself individually, but that expression is spiritual. It isn't material. So, materially, I find that, oh, I have all kinds of desires and hopes and concepts and beliefs. But as long as those material sense of life, we, as an individual, are aware that they function only in this area, in this world, and that they really have no power, we can at any moment shift into that spiritual perspective and nullify any sense of power that comes from material belief. Because this spiritual nature is omnipotent. There is no other power. Now, omnipotence isn't the power over anything. And our conditioning is such that most often when we are seeking spiritual help, we are seeking some greater power, some divine power to affect our life, to make some change in our life. But that's not the way it works. That's not the truth. The truth is that in this spiritual nature, there is no other power. So if there is a power that is affecting you in one way or another, good or bad, this is material living, is all based on this judgment, and it all has the components of good and evil, positive and negative. It has all of the opposites. Now, all of those opposites do not exist in spirit. And when we enter this spiritual dimension, we realize that the activity that is given us to do, the problems that we have to face, all the material situations, we're always rubbing up against concepts and beliefs. And these concepts and beliefs, the more that they are put, the more that we are detached from them, the more that they are not clinging to us mentally, not clinging to us in belief, then we have the opportunity to see through these appearances, as the Master said, and judge righteous judgment. See them for what they are. Now, this is the secret of developing a healing consciousness, which begins with forgiveness, because you cannot have a healing consciousness if you're living through judgment, if you're judgmental, because the only judgment that you can accept as valid is righteous judgment, which is the activity of God. What is righteous judgment? When Jesus said, judge not after appearance, but have righteous judgment, the judgment of God is love. It is this atmosphere in which we live, and the spiritual atmosphere is love. Therefore, I grew up in Christian Science, where on the wall of the church was divine love always has met and always will meet every human need. Now, that was my conditioning. So my conditioning when there was a problem is divine love. Well, what is divine love? Really, divine love is this experience of the presence of God in that now moment. And that realization of this experience of God in that now moment is an act of love. It is the love that emanates from within your own being to flow out from you and touch all those that come into your realm of experience. It is omnipresent. There is no place that we can be where we are separated from this. Now, how do we realize that omnipresence? How do we, in the midst of our being limited by human belief, realize the omnipresence of God? Well, we realize that the human belief is hypnotism. When we have taken the metaphysical steps, and the metaphysical steps are really impersonalization, which detaches us, which we feel then this detachment. We withdraw power from the material sense, and that is the realization that God is the only power. So we withdraw power mentally. And these are conscious things that we do. We use our mind. Our mind is such a multifunctional instrument because we use our mind in so many ways. We use our mind materially, but we also use our mind metaphysically to direct our perceptions, to direct our feelings, to direct our sense of self away from that material concept into the spiritual reality. So when we use our mind then to nullify this sense of power in matter, because, and then when we nullify that, we realize, well, how can that appear that way? It's a hypnotism. How does hypnotism appear anywhere? If you go to a hypnotist, to a doctor, to change some bad behavior, I mean, the most obvious is the quit smoking or something like that. What does the doctor do? He hypnotizes you so that the desire or that impulse to do that behavior seems negative, seems bad, so you don't want to do it. So then that urge to smoke is gone. When you want to smoke or you have a cigarette, then and you do it, you feel, because of this hypnotic state, you feel guilty, you feel you violated something, it doesn't taste good, and pretty soon you come to the decision that this isn't worth it, and you've dropped it. So it's hypnotism strictly on a mental level that's affecting human behavior. That is the whole material scene, is a mass hypnotism by the acceptance of a belief that there is a power outside of God. So when we use our mind, we take and we dehypnotize these beliefs. If we have been holding someone in condemnation and we realize that, oh, I've got these tools that I can use mentally to resolve that situation and nullify it. I know that if I've been holding someone in condemnation through my judgment, I can forgive myself. Forgiveness has nothing to do with anybody else, really. Forgiveness is always having to do with yourself. It's how do you want to feel? How do you want to live? If you want to feel peace, if you want to feel love, if you want to feel joy, you can't do that when you're angry at somebody or you are judging somebody and you think they're doing something wrong. Their judgment or their decisions are affecting you negatively because you don't want to do that. Okay, and the human tendency is that it's all out there. So I have to go fix this problem out there. I have to go deal with that person or deal with that situation. No, it isn't out there. Everything is within. So when you start seeing that it's within you and you start forgiving that within yourself, oh, forgive me for holding judgment. Forgive me for condemning that person. I'm not going to, this is a free country, people can have their beliefs, but forgive me for thinking that I can impose my beliefs on somebody else, or forgive me from feeling vulnerable and accepting somebody else's belief that I don't really want to accept. We have this choice. So this is that wonderful area of the mind that we develop, and we develop it through observation. We watch our reactions, we watch our feelings, we watch our emotions, and we see where are they taking us. And it's not that we discount all this. I mean, if I go to a movie and I'm going to a comedy, I want to laugh. I want to be moved and laughed. I'm not going to mentally try and shut down my emotions so I don't enjoy the movie. So it's all a matter of degree. It's all a matter of putting all of these different aspects of human life into their perspective. When it comes to just the enjoyment of a sunset or going to the beach or riding a wave, I love that. I'm not going to shut that down, but I'm not going to call it spiritual. I'm going to say this is part of this world. I really enjoy it, and this world is meant to be enjoyed. But I'm also not going to let fear, let the idea that, oh, that is dangerous, or you can't, or certain elements in this world can kill you and they can harm you, all of that sets up fear, and that fear shuts down your freedom, then you are becoming subject unto this hypnotism. Now, when we break this hypnotism by seeing through, by reasoning spiritually, which is a mental action, you know, that's what, to me, one of Isaiah's wonderful instructions, to let us reason spiritually. You know, though your sins be as scarlet, they're white as snow. What was he saying? He was saying that this world has no effect. This world has no lingering, there's no punishment. There is no quid pro quo. So that when we start to reason spiritually, it's reasoning out of the standpoint of oneness. So what happens then to this idea, this concept of punishment? this whole idea of karma. Oh, I've done something wrong, so now I'm going to have to pay the price for what I did. That's all in this world. And that price you pay is determined about how strong your beliefs are. If you really believe in reward and punishment and your life is lived out of this idea of rewarding and punishing, then you're going to experience wonderful rewards and probably strong punishments, given whatever the situation would be. But if you realize that God is love and you have that awareness that I can forgive the negative behavior, that if I'm in a group of people and people are behaving poorly, I don't have to condone that. I'm not accepting that behavior as because it's antisocial. It doesn't bring peace. It doesn't bring harmony. It doesn't allow for creativity. But I'm not going to condemn it, and I'm not going to punish it. If there is a way within yourself to resolve it mentally, then you can reason out of that and be free of that particular sense. And then you are at that standpoint to let the spirit come into your being. When I was a kid, my punishment, I never got hit or anything like that, but my punishment was getting a lecture. And usually the lecture was about spiritual principles. But when you're 7 or 8 years old, to sit for even 5 minutes, but to sit for 10 or 15 minutes and be told the truth, well, that can be quite a punishment. So everything is relative. Sorry, that's a good example, because you take and you, in your own mind, you create your own punishment. Most of your punishment is mental. It's usually fed through guilt. And guilt has nothing to do with spirit. Guilt is a human belief that there is good and evil. And when you realize, no, as soon as I step out of that paradigm that there isn't good and evil, what happens to guilt? It's gone. And then you're reasoning spiritually. Well, okay, maybe that was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. How do I rectify that mistake? I don't want to have this sense that I've made a mistake, so I'm going to be punished. How do I resolve that error? And to resolve that error, you bring it into consciousness. You have to clear all of that belief structure out of your mentality, all that good and evil, all that cause and effect. And your mind then, it becomes still. It's our meditation practice. When we bring something into consciousness, we don't take a problem into meditation. But if there's a problem, if there's something that we've done, or there's something that someone else has done, or there is a disease, or there is a sense of lack, any of this, when you can't deal with that on the level of the problem, and if you are really attached to that, you forgive yourself for that, for being attached. That breaks that attachment. And you forgive yourself for this sense of accepting this sense of material power, material good and evil. I do that all the time. I find myself in a situation and forgive me. Oh, that's horrible. Why am I accepting that? That is not really where I'm at. It's not where I want to be, and it really has no power unless I have given it power. So by forgiving yourself for accepting a belief is one of the ways that then we move out of that problem. And when we are free of this mental activity of good and evil, what ifs or if thens and all of that, when the mind finally stills, now we are in this place where we are receptive to the oneness of God. We are receptive to the nowness of God, the omnipotence of God. All of this then starts to inform. It starts to, it's one of the principles is omniscience, and this omniscience informs us, oh, there is fear not. There is nothing to fear. Fear not. I am with you. I am with you always. This comes, and then what happens to that problem or that something that you regret? That comes into this atmosphere of love, and it's dissolved. And in that dissolving of it, there can come the steps to take. Oh, how do I need to make restitution? Was this a false condemnation? Is there something that I need to say? And if I can communicate and I can express myself through this sense of detachment, through this spiritual nature, I'm not going to get involved in conflict. I'm going to be able to face someone who perhaps I've been fearful to face because there's been a conflict there. I can face that. And in facing that spiritually, in peace, that other individual cannot really affect you because you're in a state of peace. That peace is one. You're recognizing that other individual as in the same spiritual context. And suddenly, there is no conflict. Suddenly, there is a communication. I had this recently with a tenant. There was a conflict going, and I said, I'm not going to get into this conflict. I'm not going to pick up the sword. I'm not going to be upset. I'm not going to take the accusations personally and feel that I've done something wrong or that they're unjust. I didn't do anything wrong, and these are unjust accusations. And all of this was coming in, and I said, okay, I am not going to engage in that battle. And every time this tenet and this problem came into my mind, I would do this kind of reasoning. I would move myself out of the material cause and effect. I would forgive myself. I'd move through this whole area until I was at a sense of peace. When it came time for us to really make a decision, that decision was made in total peace, in total harmony. That decision gave the tenant a choice to move or to get a new lease. When that choice was there, not out of anger, not out of anything but this is the situation, the tenant came and we had the most wonderful negotiations. It was harmonious, it was intelligent, it was he understood my needs, I understood his needs, and so when we came to the agreement, everything was completely harmonious. And it's been that way now for a year since we've done this. This is how forgiveness, this is how bringing the spirit into your life can affect the way you live. And it is basically a constantly moving out from reaction, judgment, accepting matter as power, and into the oneness of spiritual being. That is freedom. That brings us such joy. I know quite a few of you have this book, but I want to fullest of joy. But I'm going to read just the section on forgiveness. It's the last part of the book, and I read it yesterday, and I thought, oh, I can. It's not. I mean, I can do this. I can share this. I mean, everybody's read it probably, but I haven't ever read it to anybody, so this is new, reading my own work. Forgiveness wipes out any attachment to material appearances and the stories they carry. Lately, our public figures seem to all be about their stories. How compelling is her story? What kind of character does someone's story reveal? Unless we detach ourselves from our personal stories, we will have difficulty maintaining clarity for spiritual manifestation. Remember, spirit can't express itself through the fog of human history. calling no person on earth your parent is prerequisite to being a spiritual transparency. Being in the world but not of it is the finest paradox. On the one hand, we have only God as our father and mother. On the other hand, our human parentage and history with which we identify links us to this world. To let go of our human history with all of its victories and defeats is to begin our journey on the mystical path. We are never going to spiritualize the material concepts, and the moment we stop trying is the moment of our freedom. One of the greatest benefits of attaining mystical consciousness is living a life without fear. That freedom gives us the perspective to look at every situation that comes into our experience without reaction and with an understanding heart. As I've said earlier about my trip on the Terry to the South Pacific, it was to be my spiritual initiation. Those who predicted this were right, and I learned a great lesson on this voyage. I had crossed oceans before, experienced awesome storms, and for the most part enjoyed it all without fear. On those voyages, my shipmates and I were young and congenial, and we looked at the extremes of weather as an adventure. The trip to the islands of French Polynesia was another story. Within days of leaving Honolulu, we met high winds and mountainous seas that broke equipment and stressed the skipper. In addition to sailing the boat and keeping it sound, my primary purpose on board was to quell the storms and give our skipper the smooth sailing he desired. The only problem was that nobody told me I was to do this, and I actually enjoyed the excitement of the rough weather. This set a tone of resentment that polluted the atmosphere all the way to Papeete. If it hadn't been for my commitment to the owner and my inner voice reminding me that this was an initiation that I would have to complete some other time if I didn't do it now, I would have jumped ship in Papeete and taken up an offer from an acquaintance on another boat in the harbor heading off for New Zealand. Seeing the islands of Polynesia had been my childhood dream. For me from the time I read Melville, London, and Stevenson. I loved the music and the dancing of the islanders, and I had studied Polynesian mythology and art while at the University of Hawaii. The adventure of sailing to islands only reached by boat and rarely visited by the outside world thrilled me. The welcoming and loving nature of the natives warmed my heart and gave me a sense of what the early explorers must have felt when they came upon these islands after living in a dark and gray Europe. When Gauguin showed his Tahitian paintings to the French, they did not believe his colors were truthful. They could not conceive of such colors in nature. And there I was, seeing what he saw, walking his lavender beaches and watching brown-skinned girls dressed in bright sarongs sitting on mats under shade trees. It was as if I was living in one of Gauguin's paintings. But for every moment of pleasure and delight, there was my Captain Bligh waiting to discredit the experience and wanting to deny me the next. Isn't that just like this world? With every bit of pleasure comes some pain. Every good carries with it a portion of evil. The coin of beauty has its dark underside. There was no middle path for me, and I bounced from the joy of the islands to the prison of the boat. I kept a journal, which as I look back on it became the garbage pail of my resentment. I feared having to be in the presence of a person who hated me, or at least found me thoroughly disappointing. I did not perform to his expectations and was soundly judged. I tried using the metaphysical principles I was taught as a child, denying the air and trying to find some comfort in God. But God was nowhere to be found. And I still had another month on the boat and a long ocean crossing ahead as we made our way back to Honolulu. How could I, who lived without fear, become so fearful? My first breakthrough came when I realized that it wasn't the person on the boat I feared. It was my own reaction to his behavior. With that realization, suddenly the hurt wasn't as deep. As we set out to cross 2,500 miles of ocean, I realized for the first time that it was completely up to me to maintain my peace. I had to develop a healing consciousness, and the object of the healing was myself. But I couldn't do that if there were always me and something out there to be corrected. At that time, our relationship could be described as cool politeness, sparked with an occasional moment of friendship or fun. Forgiveness never entered my mind. my nemesis was still arrogant and demanding. Even if he didn't apologize, how could I forgive? Forgiveness came the night that I had the experience of the sky and sea becoming one that I told about earlier. Everything about that night and that experience is still vivid in my mind. The incredible clearness of the stars, the heat of the night, the still ocean, all of these elements framed that experience. As part of that experience, a feeling of incredible peace came over me. And as I stood at the rail, my arm wrapped around a shroud, I stared out at the horizon. My personal sense of self disappeared, and the I that was experiencing this was the universal I, spiritual being itself. That which was open to me at age 17 in the presence of Joel Goldsmith opened further to reveal that there is only one I, one present, one cause, and one effect. It is at the same time infinite, eternal, and individual. Such freedom. Everything pent up in me burst out in a flood of tears that became new stars in the sea. It was all one. One body, one mind, one soul, one life, one universe, one Father, Mother, God. A purging forgiveness flowed through me and left me with nothing that could react to the pettiness of human nature. The next day, harmony prevailed. The human game of ego was shut down as the whole crew experienced the reconciliation that took us beyond ego and personality and brought us to the realization of why we set out on the voyage in the first place. It was to have been a trip celebrating love and sharing, the older generation wanting to share with the next generation the beauty and love that defined their youth in the South Seas. Everything had meaning now, and the last 2 weeks at sea were the most remarkable. They began with a sunset that stunned all of us with its beauty and variety of color, merging sea and sky into one flaming form. Then the winds came, fair and warm, speeding us toward home. We set every sail we carried, and the boat took on a new personality, as if saying, "Look at me. Look how fast I can go." The seabirds came around. One big old albatross soared over the boat, playing some wondrous game of tag with the masthead for a whole day. Then, as I related before, we encountered a pod of pilot whales that found our bow wake the perfect playground. I share these experiences for a reason. They show how walking the middle path transforms your life from one of fear and bondage to one of joy and freedom. They show that the one infinite consciousness is universal, and they underline how our change in perception changes our experience in life. No reaction to provocation goes hand in hand with the absence of fear in building a healing consciousness. I discovered that being fearless on the spiritual path is not enough. A mystic must also have a healing consciousness, which comes with the awareness of the spiritual dimension of life. You cannot live selfishly as a mystic, and you cannot live in a state of freedom if you do not recognize the oneness of all creation, and the inherent freedom built into God's manifestation. The sick, the poor, the abused, and the power-hungry people come into your consciousness to be freed of the limitations of material concepts. They come to you to be recognized as the Christ. And if you do not recognize the spiritual nature of being in the midst of discord, disease, and conflict, you will never be free of them. As you become free of the dark side of human nature, you free those who come within scope of your consciousness. The transformation that takes place within this circle of oneness appears to the world as healing, and you appear to have a healing consciousness. What you really have is an awareness of the presence of God that goes before you to make the crooked places straight, and instills in you the joy that no man can take away. So let's have a meditation to just close. Thank you. It's been a joy to share with you. And we leave next month for our lecture tour, so we will be gone for a couple of months, but I'm sure we'll see you once or twice before then.